Hey, welcome to the Everyday Sniper. You got Frank at Sniper's Hide, and we're here for part 8 of our Burger No BS BC series. I have Brian and Emil on the line, and we're going to be talking part 2 of our reloading for long-range shooting. We kind of left you guys with a cliffhanger, and here we're to follow it up and to tie it all together. So, Brian, Emil, thanks for being on the line, and appreciate it.
Yep, good to be back, Frank.
Yeah, Frank, thanks for having us.
Cool. Again, hope everybody's safe out there. And we've been crossing the country and been seeing a lot of different things. But, you know, we're all getting back into it. So let's jump right into this with the guys. We kind of left off talking primers with them. And then we were going to move on to powder charge and then seating depth. So we kind of hovered right around that powder charge place. So I'll let you guys roll into it. Where you go with your powder charges, what you're doing, and we'll kind of get into tying all the reloading together. So, you know, we can go right from there.
Sure. Hey, so I had a teaser where, you know, I talked about how people sometimes put their powder in an oven. So the spoiler alert is don't effing do that ever. And the reason why some people do that, or the reason why people think they want to do that, I should say, is powder is gunpowder is very hygroscopic by nature, meaning that it reacts very quickly to whatever the environment is in terms of moisture or humidity, and that humidity will affect burn rate. So in an attempt to get faster burning rates or get a more consistent burning rate, people have some ideas about, I need to season the powder, or I need to take the lids off of the jug and let them sit, or I might need to dry out the powder. That's probably an extraordinarily bad idea in the case of trying to do something to the powder, like heat it in order to dry it out and get it to shoot faster. We're dealing with explosive material here, really. So that's a really bad idea. Don't ever do that.
The answer is move to Arizona.
Yeah, I guess, you know. Although, you know, down in Arizona where we have, we load Burger ammunition, before we had kind of a temperature controlled and, you know, kind of humidity sort of controlled facility to load the ammo in, they could not load. I guess they have kind of a monsoon season, brief, albeit down around the Phoenix area, you know, where you get these kind of like almost haboobs, you know, that you'd get in the Middle East that come through, and you'd get these crazy swings from humidity, and they found they couldn't load during that weather because it really gave really wide velocity swings in the testing. So they would just have to shut down loading for the week or 2 weeks that they got those crazy sort of monsoons. These, you know, you go from 20% humidity all the way up to, like, you know, 80, 90% humidity within a couple of hours. And that wreaked havoc with the loading facility down there. So they had to, you know, either figure out how to get the building more proofed against humidity changes or just not load it in those cases.
Well, that is a good tip, because there's some crazy stuff out there for people to not mess with it. But I mean, humidity, like you're saying, is a big part when it's out. You know, we tend to kind of dismiss some of that, but I can totally see where guys, you know, that live in the Southeast in that area, especially now. I mean, you got the hurricane season, storms coming through. I mean, it's always wet out there, and they're stuck inside and bored, and they want to reload.
It will 100% change the burn rate of powder. I know Brian's done a little bit of study on that as well.
Yeah, we've focused on that at the lab during a recent contract where, you know, we're trying to understand and develop some ammunition that's resilient in conditions, and the moisture content of powder is definitely a big deal. I mean, to give a quick sort of like impact result that we had, 6.5 Creedmoor using 4350 powder that was vented to like 2 or 3% relative humidity environment versus powder that's soaked in like a 90% humidity environment. When we load the same charge of powder in a 6.5 Creedmoor load with a 140 hybrid, there was nearly 200 feet per second difference in the average velocity. That's a big swing. That's a big deal just by having the powder conditioned to different humidities. And, you know, it's a big variable that a lot of shooters, I don't think, realize is in their hand loading. You know, if you leave your powder over time, the powder is going to acclimate to the environment that it's in. And if your powder comes packaged at, say, 60% humidity and, you know, it vents to a higher or lower moisture content, then over time your load's going to appear to change, and guys will rationalize, like, my, maybe it's the barrel wearing, which that also has an effect, but different effect. Or, you know, they, let's say they have an 8-pounder that they've been working on for 2 years and they finally get to the end of it. Well, maybe it was vented to like 30% and they get a new jug of powder that comes at 60% and they're like, oh shit, there's, you know, a difference in this new powder. And a lot of guys think it's due to lot variations in the powder itself. Well, that also could be possible, but, you know, a lot of times I think these underlying mysteries are due to the powder venting to different humidity environments. A final way that this bites people that I can think of is whenever you load your ammo and you travel, you know, like how many competitors out there have painstakingly developed hand loads, single digit SDs, small groups, everything's good to go. And then they drive across the country to a place like the Whittington Center, and their ammo is shooting like, you know, huge SDs and muzzle velocity, huge groups at 1,000 yards. And, you know, it's just a mystery as to what is it about the travel that did this. Well, again, if they loaded in one humidity environment, those cases may or may not seal. You know, when you seed a primer in a bullet, you're not necessarily creating a hermetic seal in which the powder won't vent humidity to ambient. And sometimes, like, the best cases, if all the cases vent their powder to the same environment or none of them do. But the worst case is if you have like some of those rounds are sealed hermetically and some are not. Well, now you're going to have powder charges in there that, you know, are all different humidity levels. And that's definitely one possible reason why ammo that travels to different locations can get hosed.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it with the heat too. When guys used to come down to South Texas, you know, they'd have a load from Minnesota and they'd get down there and they'd start popping primers, you know, everything goes wrong for them because just the temperature variables were so, now our powders are better than they were back then. We're seeing a much better consistency there. But yeah, I mean, that's something to consider, is that travel for sure. Because we've seen it, you know, even on something where people consider it's a mild load where they live. And then, you know, they get down to 95, 100 degrees and it's no longer working. So for sure.
Yeah, it that happened to me literally, you know, about a couple of months ago. I developed a load here in Western Washington State, you know, about 65, 70 degrees. And I went across the mountains to shoot a match. And in Eastern Washington, you know, which is kind of like high desert, you know, kind of near Yakima, Washington, and it was 95 degrees, and started, you know, drove 3.5 hours to this rifle match. And I got out there, and once it started heating up, I got about halfway through the match and had a stuck case in the chamber. And I'd never had that happen to me. And I've always been the guy that kind of, like, you know, made fun of or scoffed at people because they didn't plan ahead and didn't really consider all the ramifications of shooting in different temperatures. And the exact same thing happened to me. And I realized that the powder I was using did have a temperature and a velocity kind of correlation, that delta in temperature, you know, resulted in a delta in velocity and pressure, and it bit me. So no, it won't happen again, at least in that caliber, but it absolutely has an effect. Yeah, I mean, cases are not hermetically sealed. If you're not sealing them, you know, i.e. with a, you know, Hernon or some other actual sealant designed to seal cases, they're not hermetically sealed. You know, even if they are hermetically sealed, they can still leak a little bit. You know, one of the tests that we do in the ammunition industry is with a bell jar. So you take you put water in a bell jar, you pull it down to a vacuum to a couple atmospheres, and then you put a round in there, and you can see sometimes even in hermetically sealed cases, a little bubble will pop out of the case. So it is an effect. I think I'd like to talk a little bit about developing like your initial sort of charge weight, because this is, you know, something I just got a new rifle and I'm actually going through that process right now of like how do you develop your charge weight for your load? You know, so I think with proliferation of chronographs, and, you know, I mean, I see it on social media, on Instagram, on Facebook, you know, everybody has a picture. They put a picture up of their lab radar screen or of their, you know, of their magneto speed. And it says, you know, SD of, you know, 3-shot group or 5-shot group, SD of 4.8, you know, like it's a contest. I win and I'm done with my load development. That's probably, that might work sometimes, but it's not the end all. Chronographs are not the end all and be all of load development for powder and the powder charge. When I was growing up, my dad used, you know, what they call the Audette method, or Creighton Audette was a really famous gunsmith from Vermont back in the day. And now it's a variation of it is the Satterlee method, where you shoot rounds at a different charge weight and you're kind of looking at velocity nodes, you know, if you will. I'm not sure that's a technically correct term, but it's the one everybody uses, where you're looking for sort of flat spots in the velocity. As you add powder charge, the velocity goes up. You're looking for the sort of these flat spots. So, you know, what I'll do is I'll make sure I'm not touching the riflings, you know, so I'll check my seating depth. And I'll seat it back like 20 thousandths off of the rifling. So I know I'm not contacting the riflings, and then I'll look in reloading manuals, or get information from, you know, other people that have shot the caliber and the bullet, you know, and you choose the appropriate powder, burn rate for the cartridge and things like that. And if people ever had any questions, the Berger Tech Line guys are very knowledgeable. They can, if you go to our website, if you go to BergerBullets.com, there's a phone number down there. You can call it. And we've got three guys that their job every day is to answer phones and give reloading advice. Nice. On calibers and bullets and stuff. You know, hey, I've got this, you know, new Berger 153.5 and I'm shooting in a 6.5 PRC. Do you have any starting point for reloading? They'll give you a powder charge and a powder type, and as a good place to start. So I'll load up. I go every 0.2 grain, and I'll do 3 shots at each powder charge. And so, you know, this is where having a chronograph like a lab radar really helps, because, you know, magneto speed, I found with some rifles, my magneto speed changes the group size and sometimes it doesn't. So magneto speed, you're strapping it on the barrel. As a pure chronograph, they're really good. But if you're testing for precision at the same time, it's hard to know if it's a real group size or not, if that makes sense. Yep. So I'll do 0.2 grain, you know, from about what I think my starting point's going to be and what I think my finishing point's going to be. So, you know, for this load I'm doing right now, I'm testing my 6.5 284, with a 144, our new 144, long range hybrid target. So I'm starting around 48 grains and then 48.2, 48.4, 48.6. And I run that all the way up to about 49.8 grains of powder. And I'll shoot 3 shots, and I'm not so much looking at standard deviations. I'm recording that information, but at the same time, I'm also shooting at a target at 600 yards. And so what I want to see is I'm looking for a correlation of where I've got kind of a flat spot in the velocity, the average velocity, you know, between charge weights. So that I want that flat spot to be within about, you know, 15 or, you know, 20 or 15 feet per second or less of maybe three consecutive charge weights. And I'm also looking on the target to where those shots start to overlap. So I'm using two metrics. I'm looking at on the target where the impact point kind of overlaps, and also on the chronograph side. So that's how I do my basic powder charge workup. It's not super complicated. I'm recording velocities, but I'm not shooting 10 shot groups at each powder charge, and I'm not picking the one that has the lowest standard deviation. That's not what I do, because sometimes when you shoot that at the target, it's not always the flattest elevation shooting one. Then you can do some tinkering in between that range of where you saw the flat spot, and then find the load that has the lowest standard deviation. But, you know, I'm trying to keep the rounds off the barrel. I'm trying to make it in as abbreviated process as I can. But I don't think shooting one round at each charge weight is enough of a sample size.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'd like to hear Brian's thoughts and your thoughts too, Frank, on that.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, so I'm familiar with that method. I've heard about it. I personally don't use that method of load development. Not because I think it's bad or it's wrong. I think that the mechanism behind what makes all that work is a gun dynamic called positive compensation. And what goes on with that is basically the attenuation of the gun, or the harmonics, or the combination of the barrel and the stock, the way it's all put together, results in the faster than average shots impacting lower on the target at like 100 yards, and the slower than average rounds impacting higher. And the result at long range is that you sort of have a vertical convergence of your group. That's the flat spots that Amos talking about. So that's the theory, the mechanical theory behind what makes that work. And that theory is sound, but it's most relevant for guns that have, like, you know, thin barrels or are attached to the stocks, like the Lee Enfield rifles are very well known for positive compensation. In my opinion, modern precision rifles with, you know, free-floated bull barrels, you know, shooting light, fast rounds especially, have, you know, very little potential. There's just very small amount of harmonics going on, so it's very hard to detect. And if you can, you might have an edge. That method might give you an edge in your load development, you know, to hit on the right spot. But I think that dynamic is very minimized with modern, well-built precision rifles. But it's a good example where, like, the chronograph isn't giving you the full story. You know, the chronograph's only giving you the velocity piece, whereas, you know, you actually have to put holes in paper at distance to see how those velocities combine with the gun dynamics. That's just something you have to do with live fire. But I don't do any of that. I work up my powder charge by, you know, I work it up in about half a grain increments till I see pressure on the brass, and then I drop it back a grain or two. And unless I just can't get that powder charge to work, which normally it can, you know, I don't usually change the powder charge after that. I'm not very finicky when it comes to identifying the correct load, as far as, like, is it 43.2 or 43.3? Where I pay the most attention to my hand loading process is the powder, like the consistency that charge is thrown. You know, like I'm really particular about weighing the powder charges and getting it to, you know, within a kernel if I can. You know, so whatever my load is, I try to make it very consistent, and also considering humidity effects as well. You know, so traveling, they have those humidity packs that you can put with your cigars, you know, that'll, like, hold the humidity of your cigar box at a certain 63% or whatever. You know, I put those in with my ammo to sort of keep the powder conditioned to the environment right up until the ammo box is open. So those are sort of my powder considerations with load development and hand loading.
Yeah, man. First, I want to just say that's awesome that Berger has that, you know, that hotline for guys to call in. I think like Scott's method is a abbreviation of Dan Newberry's, the ladder test that Dan did, which was a little bit more detailed. And then I think Scott kind of boiled it down to do less rounds than Dan, if I'm correct, with Dan being the inventor of that. But he used to be on the Hyde years ago and discussed it quite a bit. Then the last time I worked up one of the things I do is because we have a pretty big reloading section on the Hyde, I'll initially kind of go through because we have it broken down by the bullets and things like that, the calibers and bullet weights. And I'll look at what I'm consistently seeing with guys that they're doing out there in a reference. You know, if I'm always seeing that 43 grains coming up, then I'll sort of start around there. But I'm not going like maxed out, or I want to cross a certain speed, but then I'm not too picky about where I am around it. And then, you know, then I'm going for that accuracy at distance. Amo was saying 600 yards. I know I play mine around 300 on paper. And so I'll look at it there because, like Brian says, I want to put a bullet to paper and then see what that looks like. And as long as I'm pretty close to, you know, when my mind should be a good speed for that. And of course, I'm using a chronograph just to get me started there. Then after that, I could start fine tuning it. But yeah, I mean, I guess we're all in the same place, just small variations of how we're doing it. You know, as far as a starting reference point, you know, that's something safe in putting it. And then, like I said, I'm kind of more looking for a speed. The last one I worked up with was like the 185 Juggernaut. And then I use a 46 grain of 2000 MR. And this has been a really good, consistent load that I can repeat over and over again. And so that's something that, you know, has been replicated pretty well. And I'm nowhere near max. It's like 48 grains is max. And I'm down at 46. Hang on one sec. You guys can talk about that.
Okay. Yeah. So there, I want to sort of bring in another layer of this conversation. It has to do with the ladder testing, but also all the work that we do in hand loading and much of shooting in general. You know, talk about the tool that we use for all this, the one tool that's in common, the most important tool that we have, you know, the human brain. Okay. I've got this weird fascination with how brains work, and the brain, like the cortex of our brain that we use to reason with, is basically overgrown material from our sensory cortexes, like your visual cortex. And the job of that part of your brain is to make sense of stuff. Like something appears to you that is out of the ordinary, it grabs your attention and your brain works on it until it says, oh, that's a bird, or, you know, that asshole is going to cut you off on the highway, and so you do something about it. But that's the material, that's the brain material that we're working with. We try to make sense of things, and we're not comfortable until we do. And so that's what we're always trying to do with hand loading, right, is to make correlations. Like, I did this, it got better. I did that, it got worse. And we're satisfied when we make that correlation, but we don't always make, there's no requirement of the brain to come to the right conclusion. Just as long as it makes sense and we can explain it, then we're happy. You know, the flat earthers have their rationalizations that are incorrect, but they're happy with them. And I think a lot of hand loaders have rationalizations that they're happy with as well that aren't necessarily correct, but they make sense in a way. So using the ladder testing as an example of that, you know, give a quick example, quick story. We had a young engineer come intern with Applied Ballistics, and he was talking about his load development, and he did one shot at each powder charge. And he was showing me on the plot how it leveled out here, you know, in velocity. And he's like, yep, that's where I want my load to be. There's a velocity node there. And I said, okay. Now, the hallmark of good science is repeatability. Right? If you can't repeat a result again and again, it's not really genuine. It just means it happened that day. But we are looking for things that are repeatable, right? For genuine cause-effect sort of causal relationships. So I told him, all right, I said, now he only did one shot per powder charge. This is key. So I told him, I said, do that test again, exactly the same way that you did. Repeat that test and you should find a flat spot at that same charge, right? He said, oh yeah, absolutely confident. So he repeated the test, and the flat spot wasn't at the same powder charge. It was a grain or two different. And I said, okay, do it a third time. And a third time he did it, and there was still a flat spot if you just looked at that run, but it didn't line up with either the previous two. And when you looked at all three plots together, it was just kind of a scatter of, okay, the more powder you put in, the faster it goes. And there was no real repeatable node or flat spot whenever he did it three times. Now, the way that AMO does it with three shots per charge, that's a whole lot more valid, because now you're averaging three shots together. And if you do find a flat spot or a node, it's much more likely to be genuine and repeatable because it's established on three shots instead of one. So that's an example of how, you know, what if you just do it one time, you'll see something, you'll be convinced that it's real. But that a lot of times that's just your brain trying to make sense. You know, your brain is not satisfied if it doesn't have an explanation. So a lot of times it jumps to conclusions and they're not always correct. So, you know, another example related to hand loading is guys get a new gun, new barrel, and they start on their load development and they go to the range with, you know, different loads, come back to the range with refinements, on and on. And eventually they get to a point they're happy. They're shooting half minute groups with single digit SDs and they're happy. Well, that doesn't mean that all the loads they tried before weren't good. You know, a new gun, the load isn't the only thing that you're refining. A lot of times you're refining the way that you shoot it, you know, how you're loading the bipod, how you're getting to know the trigger, you know, you're getting to know the, you're probably making adjustments to the length of pull, kind of fitting it to yourself. And meanwhile, the barrel's breaking in, you know, making it easier to get those consistent velocities. But in the shooter's mind, since he's testing loads, everything is seen in the context of which load is better. Well, meanwhile, you know, the baseline is just improving for everything as you refine your shooting and breaking the barrel in. So, you know, I always encourage hand loaders to, you know, consider other possibilities that might explain their observations. It may not be the first thing that comes to mind, even though that may explain it, that may not be the reality of it. So, you know, use that best tool that we have, and, you know, if you think you've found something that's genuine, try to repeat it. If you can repeat it and it does the same thing every time, then you know for sure that that's it. But if it doesn't repeat, as uncomfortable as it is to go forward with uncertainty, you've got to keep searching. Otherwise, you're kidding yourself about what you know.
Yeah, again, that's great advice. Oh, go ahead, Emil.
Yeah, I mean, that's it really is illuminating if you think about it in context, how you can talk yourself into conclusions because it makes you feel better. And the thing that we fight against as shooters a lot too is, you know, a lot of these calibers that we like to shoot, you know, they're not your dad's 308. You know, some of these rifles, you know, usable barrel life is, you know, well under 2,000 rounds in some cases. You know, the 6.5-24 that I'm playing with, you know, I'm reserving it only for 1,000-yard competitions, and I'm assuming that much past 11 or 1,200 rounds on the barrel, it's not going to be usable, won't be capable of winning a match in national-level competition. So guys get a little bit nervous and antsy, especially if they're shooting a rifle or a caliber. You know, so many of these overbore calibers out there now that are in common use where they just eat barrels like pistachio nuts sitting at a bar. And, you know, so guys are almost in a rush to find the right number. So they'll take whatever, you know, to kind of tag on what Brian said, they'll take whatever kind of information confirms their thought process and just latch onto it. So that's a really great cautionary tale to just be aware that that's happening to your brain the exact same time you're trying to test scientifically. I mean, if we wanted to test exhaustively, you know, with some of these rifles, you'd shoot the barrel out on the rifle before you really learned anything. And then it's time to move on to the next barrel because the next barrel might be different than the previous barrel, right?
That's the anal retentive reloader, right?
We did that very thing on the ESO program with the 375 enablers, you know, to fully understand a load, because these guys, they're not out in the field load developing for these sniper guns. They're issued ammo and it's got to work for the entire life cycle of the barrel from beginning to end. So, you know, we did that. We wore out barrels with the same load just to see how the velocity migration worked throughout, how the SD is affected. And it's amazing how much the character of a load will change through the life of a barrel, you know. And if you were changing a load, trying to improve it along the way, you would not know what effect the barrel was having on that, because there's two variables going on. you know, but by doing, by wearing out numerous barrels with the same load, you know, putting 1,000 rounds, this exact same load, you see, oh yeah, the velocity picks up over 100 feet per second from a new barrel to a broken in barrel. And also the SDs, like, you never get good SDs in the first 200 rounds. But then if you just keep shooting the same load, after 200 rounds, you start getting SDs of 4, 5, 6 feet per second on 10 shot strings. Whereas when the barrel was new, you know, you were looking at 10, 12, 15 feet per second, you know, not changing anything about the ammo. And so that's what I'm talking about when I say, you know, we try to correlate cause and effect with what we're testing deliberately. But a lot of times there's influential things under the surface that are impacting our result that we're not tuned into.
Yep. Yep. So once we have our charge, where are you guys going with your seating depth?
So for me, I think it depends on your intended purpose with the rifle and your equipment, right? So if you're shooting out of the magazine, right? If you need to load out of the magazine, you know, if you're doing PRS or some sort of tactical thingamabob where you have to be magazine fed, then you really are, your seating depth is kind of limited. I mean, depending upon what, you know, what the chamber is in the rifle, if we just assume it's a, you know, it's a standard SAMI CIP chamber design, then you're really at the mercy of the bullet. So it would behoove, to use a word that everybody used in the Army and the military that I don't think they really, it's the only word they ever use that they thought sounded like a big word.
Yes.
So every sergeant was like, it will behoove you. Like, okay, dude.
Yeah, okay. Totally.
You say behoove every day. We get it. All right. You know what behoove means. So it's like El Guapo saying a plethora. You know, it would be advantageous to pick a bullet, you know, that can tolerate different levels of jump. And that's, you know, those hybrid bullets, you know, the bullets that Brian, you know, that were birthed out of, you know, the center of Brian's forehead, they do a great job in that, to where, you know, they can shoot well close to the riflings. They can shoot well really far away from the riflings. I mean, I shot at world championships jumping bullets, you know, 80 thousandths of an inch, and that's just where I thought that's where they shot the best, and that was, you know, that would have fit in a magazine. So if you're shooting out of a magazine, you know, you're really, you know, you're loading to the magazine length, and then it's really about sorting through bullets maybe to see what tolerates the jump better. In the competition that I kind of do in an F class, you know, there's a lot more, you're single loading these rounds. So you can kind of pick whatever the seating depth is that you want. And again, for me and, you know, guys in F class world, there's two ways that they approach it. One is, you know, they'll do a seat depth test, just like I described with the powder test. And that's always on a target. And, you know, 600 yards is an easy, at least where I live, it's an easy place to test because there's not a lot of wind here in Western Washington. And I don't think you need to shoot at 600 yards because the bullet has, quote, gone to sleep or it's not going to do anything. I think you could do all that same testing at short range. I'd like to hear Brian's thoughts on that too. But the reason I test at 600 yards is I can see the change in the shots easier. You know, so it might be harder for me to analyze, you know, where I'm holding. Maybe my hold moved a quarter inch up or down. I didn't realize it when I pulled the trigger at 100 yards. But at 600 yards, I'm going to see the separation in those shots more. So for me, it's an easier analytical tool to test at that greater distance because I can see the difference in the seating depths. So on seating depth, I change I do seating depth increments in, I know about where I want to be based on feedback from other shooters. And, you know, like, you know, I know that, you know, like the Burger 180 hybrid likes to be jumped between like, you know, 10 thousandths and like 30 something thousandths. So I might change my seat depth in like, you know, every 3 or 4 thousandths, and I'll shoot again 3 shot groups on a target, and I'm looking at elevation. So how tall my group is at those ranges. And then I'm already, that's with a charge weight that I've already decided on. So I'm picking seek depth for me in the NRA prone world and in the F class world, I'm picking my seek depth only on what kind of elevation it yields on the target. And then with tuners, guys that use tuners, and there's kind of a black art voodoo with using a tuner, you know, on a barrel. Basically, you have a movable piece of metal that changes you hang a piece of metal on the end of a barrel and you can move it fore and aft on the barrel and it changes how the barrel vibrates. Guys that believe in tuners and have good results with them, they dial in the they kind of like leave it at a set jump point, be it 20 or 25 thousandths jumping to the riflings, and then they make their adjustments on a tuner in order to get the flattest elevation for their load.
Not a lot of new tuners are coming out right now. There's like 3 or 4 new ones that just hit the street.
Yeah. I know that Brian's done a lot of Mythbuster stuff. Brian, have you ever kind of gone down the tuner rabbit hole?
Not too deeply. I've not had a tuner on a competition rifle that I've shot. Where I've seen a convincing correlation with tuners is with short range bench rest guns like the 6 PPCs, where they're spinning the bullet so slow. Like, I don't know if they're 13 or 15 twist barrels shooting flat base, you know, 68 grain, 6 millimeter bullets. And they're deliberately shooting those bullets right on the low end of stability, like extremely low stability, just trying to spin it as gently as possible to make those bug hole groups. And in those cases, I've seen, you know, pretty convincing correlations with tuner settings and point of impact. They'll even show where you can, you know, dial a tuner and watch the bullet holes go from round to oblong. And it's like, holy shit, you know, how's the tuner affecting stability? Well, in that scenario, in that setup, you're dealing with bullets that are so on that ragged edge of stability that any little thing you nudge it with is going to, you know, have an effect. It'll make it either tip this way or tip that way. And so in that sense, I've seen it have an effect. But when you're dealing with bullets that are well stabilized and, you know, a gun that's well put together, I've seen guys claim, oh yeah, I got my tuner figured out and at this humidity and this elevation, I got to set it here. And, you know, halfway through the match, they're confused and dialing it in, dialing it out. Other guys think that their tuner setting is dependent on seating depth and they ignore humidity. So it's just kind of, I agree with Emil about there being a lot of voodoo in tuners, just because they might have an effect in some limited areas like, you know, low stability bullets doesn't mean they're going to have an effect on bullets that are fully stabilized. So, you know, I shoot down a lot of ideas, or maybe not shoot them down conclusively, but I bring a lot of skepticism to the hand loading conversation because I've just seen so many claims that did not hold up to rigorous testing. You know, it's so painting in very broad strokes, what I've sort of come to believe with few exceptions is that the ammo is going to determine your standard deviation in muzzle velocity and the standard deviation in the bullet BC. Those, the consistency that matters at long range is an inherent attribute of the ammunition. The precision of the system, like how small of a group you're going to shoot, is primarily due to the gun and not the ammo. You know, if you have a bad gun, no matter how much tweaking you do with hand loads, you're not going to shoot good groups. And on the other side, if you have a good gun, any gun that shoots half-minute groups with any ammo is probably going to shoot damn good with any other kind of ammo. You know, so it's not absolute. I mean, there's definitely effects that will affect the consistency of your muzzle velocity SD, for example. And there's, you can have ammo that's ill-fitted to a gun and cause bigger groups, but it's probably like an 80-20 relationship where 80% of the consistency of your system comes from the ammo and 80% of the precision in your system is just an inherent attribute of the gun. that's kind of what, you know, that's how I sort of set my expectations. When, if I have a gun that's shooting a 3-minute group, I'm not going to be dicking with seating depth or, you know, brass prep or anything. That's just a gun that doesn't shoot, you know, for the most part. And there's exceptions. You might be shooting a bullet that isn't stable or whatever, but it, for the most part, a gun that will shoot most ammo. A gun that won't, just won't.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I start out on the skeptical side when we're talking about claims of, you know, cause-effect relationship and hand loading that's going to make small groups.
Yep. And I'm with what Emil talked about. I'm on the tactical side. I always reload to that 2.830 for me because I'm going to be putting it into my magazines. And so to me, that's kind of where I want to sit. So I don't chase that as much just because I'm going off my AI mags, you know, and mm-hmm. I'm not pulling the front out. I'm not trying to open them up or chase what mag I have to get a little bit more here or there. So to me, if I can reload it to this place, and then that's where I tune it up for it, the velocity wise and things, then, you know, that's where I want to be. And so mine's really simple. That's it, is I'm going mag length, to be inside, to not foul my bullet up when I'm loading, catch the front of the nose of the mag, something yep. like that.
And you're gonna seat that length, and then it'll work or it won't. And that, because you can't go longer, you can't experiment, because you need a repeater, you know.
Exactly.
And so one more comment about seating depth, from a bullet designer perspective. You know, the hybrid bullets were designed to be jump tolerant, you know, to where you don't have to hone in on exactly the seating depth that is the only seating depth that'll shoot good groups. And the way that we tested that is, every new hybrid bullet design, you know, I'd get sent the prototypes, and I would load them to 15 thousandths jump, 30 thou, 45, and 60. So 15 thou increments from 15 to 60 thou off the lands. And the goal was that the bullets would shoot the same, about the same groups at all those seating depths. And for the most part, they do. You know, you can go through that entire range and your groups are not going to systematically get bigger or smaller along the way. And I'm talking numerous 5-shot groups at each seating depth. And so whenever we observe that result, like, man, we went from 15 to 60 thousandths in 4 steps, and the groups were all about half minute, you know? So that's my perspective on seating depth. So when guys talk about, wow, I shot a half minute group with 15 thou jump, I'm going to start stepping back in 3 thou increments all the way over whatever span. It's like, man, you're dealing with a bullet that isn't sensitive to that. So turning that knob in for those bullets isn't going to change much at all, you know?
Yep. And then that's kind of like back in the day, why, you know, I would go more towards the Lapua side of things, and because they weren't as sensitive and they're a little bit more forgiving for that. So when I was seated back there, I didn't have to get close to the lands or touch it or do any of that stuff. So now with the hybrids, you know, you're in that same place, and it's exactly that. And they tend to help me out a little bit because I'm not chasing that back and forth, and because I don't have that ability with magazines.
Yeah, of course, some bullets are sensitive to it. You know, like the aggressive secant designs, the BLD designs are very well known for being highly sensitive to seating depth. That's one aspect of ammunition that can have a big effect on precision. You know, I said it's mostly the gun. Well, if you've got BLD bullets, the seating length of your ammo is going to impact your precision in a noticeable amount. And so for that reason, you know, that if you're shooting a bullet like that, you need to do that seating depth test. But a mistake that a lot of hand loaders make is they understand that about VLDs, but they don't understand that it's unique to VLDs. So they take that practice of, you know, messing with all these seating lengths and apply it to bullets that aren't sensitive to it. And it's, you know, a lot of time it's wasted time.
No, great advice. So we hit that part. Where were we? There was one other thing I think we wanted to cover. I think Emil had something we talked about just prior, because we're coming up on that hour with us. And I got to check out. I already have my cleaning lady trying to bang on the door. But
so, housekeeping.
Yes, she was totally. She was
eat sleepy. I wanted to get Brian's take on velocity variations at distance. You know, this, you know, I know that in the ELR world, it's you really have to load to the kernel of powder. And you know why that is important, and you know, and that effect is magnified over distance. You know, if you're shooting 300 yards, I mean, you can load on a Chargemaster, you could load on a, you know, on one of those Harrells just to powder dump and probably never see the difference, you know, on most of the targets we shoot at. But you start shooting at 2,000 yards, 2,500 yards, 3,000 yards, and you're really going to see it. I know Brian's got some metrics on that. And that might be a good place to kind of let us end with a little science.
Yep. Perfect.
Right. So, yeah, the ELR game is everything, consistency. I mean, those targets, most of them in the 2 mile range go unhit. You know, most shots at 2 miles don't connect. And it's because the consistency that you would need to hit those targets reliably is extremely difficult. And it's not really possible to achieve that kind of consistency on 2 mile targets repeatedly. So, for example, we did an analysis at the King of 2 miles. From the top to the bottom of the plate is an 8 foot per second difference. Like if everything else was perfect, if your gun was shooting at zero group, every BC was the same, your aim was perfect, you go from the top to the bottom of that target in 8 feet per second of muzzle velocity. And so when you add that into all the other real world effects, it becomes incredibly difficult, you know, to have extreme spreads under 8 feet per second and hit that target reliably. So yeah, weighing powder the kernel, everything you can do to drive your SDs down, SDs in muzzle velocity and BC. I published an article recently about the relative effects of those two things. I, you know, tried to pick something nominal that applied to sort of PRS and ELR kind of in the middle. It was a 300 Norma with 215 hybrids at 3,000 feet per second. And looking at the relative effects of BC on, or standard deviation on BC and standard deviation on muzzle velocity. That's kind of the essence of our No BS BC campaign that we're, you know, talking about here, is bringing some of these consistency aspects to light. And basically, I mean, it's a graphical thing. It's kind of like a trumpet, but the way it breaks down is a 0.5% standard deviation on your BC has about the same effect as a 5 foot per second SD on your muzzle velocity. So, you know, 5 and 0.5, you can think of it that way. And then if you go to like a 1% SD on your BC, that has about the same effect as a 10 foot per second SD on muzzle velocity. Now, 1% SD on BC, to put that in perspective, that's the standard for Burger bullets. Like our long range bullets, they're, you know, tested, verified that they're going to be under 1%. The good batches are 0.5%, but they have to be under 1%. And we've seen a lot of, you know, competitors' bullets that we've measured, you know, shooters would never know this, but, you know, the Doppler radar measurements are clear. You know, you can have 1-3% SD of BC on a lot of bullets that are marketed for long range out there. And guys don't know if they'll still shoot good groups at 100. You may still get very consistent muzzle velocities, but if you're shooting at long range targets with bullets that have 2% standard deviation on BC, you're just going to have a hard day. You know, 2 feet or 2% BCSD is comparable effect to a 20 foot per second SD on muzzle velocity, which everybody just knows is completely out of line for long range ammo. But they're comparable effect in terms of vertical dispersion in the 1,000 to 1,500 yard range. Now, the muzzle velocity dispersion sets on earlier. You know, you'll see more of that in the 600 to 1,000 yard range, whereas the variation in BC is a cumulative effect. So it's not so bad through 600 to 1,000 yards, but beyond 1,000, it starts to really ramp up and it just really cascades beyond that. And, you know, so if you have, naturally in a realistic shooting system, you have both, you know, SDs on your muzzle velocity and your BC. You've also got the inherent group size that you're shooting. And all these other factors that come together. And a common question about this is, you know, how this all adds. Like if you have a 1% BCSD and a 10 foot per second muzzle velocity SD, you know, and let's say they both give you 5 inches of vertical at 1,000. Well, does that mean that your group's going to be 10 inches tall? Well, worst case scenario, it could be that tall because those two things would stack in the same direction. But statistically, variables with random directions are added by the root sum square method. That's something you can look up. I won't try to explain it in the little time we have left, but if you look up root sum squares, that shows you how you can add not just two, but three, four, five sources of random error and give you what your statistical likely dispersion would result from that. So that's kind of the spiel, you know, the essence of this No BSBC campaign is understanding all these variables, especially the consistency of bullets that we do pretty well at Berger. We put a lot of work in to make sure these bullets are consistent and that, you know, they're verified to have, you know, low standard deviations in BC because we know how that manifests at long range. Even though the shooters can't measure it directly, they're eventually going to see better consistency and more success at long range if they have that going for them.
Nice. Now, one question did come in because we're in the ELR zone, just to jump really quick, is they asked how come King of 2 Mile people are using virgin brass?
Yep. So the brass work that you do is different and in some ways more difficult with the larger cartridges. In particular, what we've seen with like the Chi-Tac and larger size cartridges is, you know, the 375 enabler class, is that the brass is really good when it's new. You know, Peterson's making a lot of this brass. It's consistent on the first firing, but after that, it seems to harden faster than smaller cartridge cases. By harden, I mean it needs annealed. It doesn't take a resize. There's just so much length of brass there that you resize it like you normally would to give, you know, 3 or 4 thousandths of headspace. And a lot of times, because of how long it is, it can spring back and absorb that, you know, as a percentage of length. You know, your 308 that's, you know, fired case might spring back 1 thousandths. Well, that's not a big deal on a 3 or 4 thousandths headspace. You're still achieving an effective resize. But whenever the case is three times longer, well, now that's 3 thousandths of spring back. And if you're only making 3 to 4 thousandths of headspace, it's easy to see how you get into a problem really quick. So, and also the dies are not as well standardized for those larger cartridges. You know, millions of people shoot 308 and 6.5 Creedmoor. And so there's a big market for it. It's very standardized. But the dies for this larger stuff, there's fewer people that make them. They don't always make them the same. And there's more user expertise required to set them up. It's, you know, it's not as straightforward to set them up. So because of all of that, you know, all those challenges, you can load good ammo on fired, you know, several times fired brass for these larger cartridges, but it takes a lot more experience to do it well and to actually make reloads that are as good as you can make on, you know, virgin brass.
Nice. That's a great way to answer it. So hopefully that answers for the guys out there asking that, because that did come up. But yeah, is there anything else we can kind of wrap this one up and let you guys get back to work and all that, and then I can, you know, let my housekeeper in. I think this is a great discussion. Flowed really well. A lot of knowledge here. A lot of information. It's another knowledge bomb. B-52 is coming over. So guys will be listening to it more than once. But for the Berger No BS BC series, I think this put it all together really well.
Yeah, I think it went well. I really enjoy these conversations. I you know, I don't enjoy like popping people's bubbles, but there's this skeptical part of me that, you know, and having done a lot of the testing that we have, is like, you know, I'm doing a disservice, I think, if I, you know, don't engage the conversation and provoke some critical thinking, because, you know, I like shooting. I like being around shooters and I want to see them successful. And if I believe that someone's on a path that they're spinning their wheels or they could be doing better to pay more attention in other places, you know, I'm going to pipe up about it. And this podcast is a great platform to do that. So I really appreciate coming on here and talking.
Awesome. Thanks, yeah. Both of you guys.
Yeah, Frank, I appreciate it. You know, from the Berger Bullet side, really like to thank you for hosting this and letting us, you know, get our message out and let us kind of, you know, interface with your listeners and the people in your community. I think it's been really beneficial for me personally. I've learned a lot talking to you and talking to Brian about this. So I want to just tag our nobsbc.com website and our website, burgerbullets.com. Lots of resources on there, twist rate calculator, ballistics calculator, all these articles that we have. You know, and our new ammunition, we've got two new ammo products, 6.5 Creedmoor, what in 144 grain long range hybrid target, and then a 153.5 grain long range hybrid target, which is actually performing very well out of a standard 6.5 Creedmoor. So, yeah, so appreciate the opportunity, Frank.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's great because, you know, it always seemed in the years that, you know, Brian and I, we have a passion and we both kind of butt heads with the passion, but it's not that way. It's we're fans of this. We're passionate about what we do. And I think this really helps put all that together for people to realize, you know, there's a lot more similar than anything else out there. So, yeah, thank you guys. Thanks to the listeners that have made this so popular. Thanks to Burger and, you know, you guys for setting it up and taking the time. This has been a lot of time, you know, and I really appreciate that. It means a lot.
Awesome.
All right, man. We'll talk to you next time.
You got it, buddy. Thanks.